Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. The website The Ringer recently ran a bracket to determine the best TV character of the century, and the winner was Michael Scott, Steve Carell's character from the mid-aughts NBC sitcom, The Office. Ironically, it was this very character that almost got The Office canceled after its first season, according to Rolling Stone's Andy Green. This is one of the many fascinating facts Andy covers in his oral history, The Office, the untold story of the greatest sitcom of the 2000s. That subtitle may sound like a hyperbolic boast, so we Skyped him to find out more. Andy says in 2005, the sitcom was in desperate need of a reboot.
Sitcoms at the time were just all Friends knockoffs. It was a really awful time for sitcoms in the early aughts. That Friends was so popular, but it inspired all of these really boring paint-by-numbers shows about beautiful young people who were living in giant apartments all in New York City. And it felt so unmoored into reality. It felt so fake that when The Office came, as goofy as the show was, it was a slice of real life in a way. It was so refreshing that there was no laugh track. And there was no music, and they didn't look like models. It was just so against the grain of most shows at the time that there's a hunger to see that.
The Office is based on the British BBC TV series of the same name. It was created by Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant, and it starred Ricky as David Brent. How did the American version happen?
It was somewhat by coincidence. There is a TV executive named Ben Soverman that was in London, and he was going through the channels and he saw the show and he was confused for a few minutes because he thought it was real, but he realized it was fake and he couldn't stop laughing. It was so clever.
The man who gives the jobs in the warehouse is a personal friend of mine. All right? Sammy, you old slag. It's the Brentmeister General. Have you ever tried the forklift driver's job? No, good. Don't bother. I've got the man here. He's perfect. Has he passed his forklift driver's tests? He gives the tests. Yeah. We'll get a CV over to you this afternoon. Oh, is Elaine? She left you yet? Yeah. All right, see you then. She has left him. I forgot about that.
He called Ricky up. They met at a Starbucks, and he bought the rights to the show. And he shopped it around, and so many networks, they turned it down. It was so different that they didn't want it. But he got NBC to be bold and to buy a pilot.
Greg Daniels worked on Saturday Night Live, The Simpsons, and King of the Hill before he ended up in charge of the American adaptation of The Office. What was it about Greg that made him the right guy for the job?
He's really funny and a great writer. He wrote some of the best episodes of The Simpsons, and he ran King of the Hill. And if you watch that show, you can feel some vibes of The Office in King of the Hill. It's so different than most cartoon shows. It's just a regular family in the middle of Texas. They're very working class.
Firm, but with a little give. Yep, these are medium rare.
What if somebody wants theirs well done?
We ask them politely yet firmly to leave.
In the show, it felt so realistic, and that same vibe was brought to The Office by Greg Daniels.
Mm-hmm. It kind of makes me think, as you were answering that, it made me think of the famous Alfred Hitchcock quote about drama is life with the dull bits cut out. And it seems to me, as you were talking about King of the Hill and to a certain extent The Office, they would leave some of those dull bits in and milk them for comedy.
Yeah, and that's crucial because the rhythm of most sitcoms for 50 years was almost the sing-song rhythm of line, zinger, laugh track, line, zinger, laugh track. Mm-hmm. It was so predictable and very played out, and there was no awkward silences. There were no boring parts. But when I interviewed Ricky Gervais, he told me that he was fascinated by awkwardness in real life and fascinated by embarrassment and jokes that fall flat, and just tension of silence. And silence is very funny if it's used effectively. But that's hard to do on a sitcom where you have 21 minutes and you're trying to appeal to the widest possible audience. But Greg and the Office gang, they were bold enough to kind of use silence in very smart ways.
What kind of resistance did Greg Daniels and Ben Silverman face when they were trying to convince NBC executives that this show would work?
It was a show that didn't have stars. It took place in a very unglamorous part of the country at a very unglamorous job. And you couldn't think of a more boring premise for a show for the mundane lives of struggling workers at a failing paper company in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And back in 2003 and 2004, when it was being shopped around, it was the tail end of sort of the pre-streaming era and even the pre-cable era for a lot of shows, where the network still had huge audiences. And to take a risk on a show that different was just such a crazy idea that Fox and CBS and ABC and HBO all either said no or we'll think about it, but with big changes. And on the big change that they all wanted, they wanted a laugh track. And they wanted it to be multicam, and they refused.
What part do you think the mockumentary format played in the success of The Office?
I think it was just a great and different way to present a show. It was inspired by reality shows that were popping up at the time, and it was even filmed by the same camera team that did Survivor. And just taking that language of the reality show where you see a scene with sort of a shaky camera, and then you see a talking interview where they're talking about the inner dialogue of that moment, was such a unique way just to present a sitcom that they were fascinated by it.
Yeah, and that's one of many interesting things I learned from your book is about having the Survivor camera crew to shoot The Office. So that played a huge part, I would say, in the success of the show.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. And I spoke to that camera team, and it was fascinating to me that they didn't watch rehearsal, really, that they would just go in there and they shoot it the same way that they shot Survivor, by just capturing things as it happened.
Yeah. Let's talk about the pilot of the American version of The Office. How did that turn out?
It was a disaster, and they all regret it. They very foolishly decided to do almost a shot-for-shot remake of the British Office. And it forced Steve Carell to do a sort of impersonation of Ricky Gervais. And the Gervais character, which was named David Brent, was really aggressive, really cruel, and he had no real redeeming qualities. So he mock fires Pam in the pilot, who is his secretary, and she's sobbing, and she's heartbroken, and he's laughing at her.
You're an ex-punk! Surprise! It's a joke! We were joking around! See? Okay. He was in on it. He was my accomplice. And there was just kind of a morale booster thing, and we were showing the new guy around, kind of giving him the feel of the place. So, we totally got you.
You're a jerk.
I don't know about that.
Test audiences and the actual audiences, they hated it. It just didn't work, and the critics just tore it to bits.
So NBC picks up The Office for 5 more episodes, and the first of these 5 is called Diversity Day. How did Diversity Day turn out?
That was groundbreaking. And that was the first time that they did their own thing, which was obviously very early. And they tackled race in a very head-on way. And it was really bold. And if you watch it now, it's kind of shocking. You've seen Michael Scott use the N-word numerous times. I mean, it's a Chris Rock bit that he's quoting, but it's still, it's intense. It's not the sort of thing that would fly these days, perhaps, and with good reason, maybe. But it's also very funny in how shocking it is. And it was sort of the first sign that the show was going to go in its own direction. But it still had a ways to go. It was still, they had a major problem at that point still, that Michael Scott was still cruel and vindictive and openly racist and just not a good guy.
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest changes that the writers made from the first season to the second season was rejigging Steve Carell's character, the boss, Michael Scott. As you mentioned, he was abrasive and kind of a bully and not seen as a good guy. How did they make those changes to the character?
Well, they knew they had to do something because the show was almost canceled and the audiences, they hated Michael Scott. But they didn't know quite what to do until that summer when they saw The 40-Year-Old Virgin, which came out in the summer of 05, which was between season one and two. And they saw Steve Carell play a character who was very lonely, very sad, and just living a sort of desperate life. But he infused the character with so much warmth that you loved the guy, that you felt bad for him, that you really felt this person's pain.
You know what? I'm a virgin too. Hey, you, that's...
We're virgins too.
Yeah.
No, you know what? It's a personal choice, and I don't think it's weird at all.
Okay, I can't listen to any more of this because it's making me sick, so bye.
You can get this information on your website, right?
Oh, yes.
Thanks. Nice meeting everybody.
And they brought a lot of those characteristics into the retooled Michael Scott in the second season. They made a big point of showing that he's a man who has no friends, who has no family, yearns for more, and sees his colleagues as his friends and his family. And if you understand that, then you forgive a lot of his bad parts because you realize he's just acting out.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Dwight Schrute. Unlike the rest of the Dunder Mifflin universe, Rainn Wilson's portrayal of Dwight worked well right from the start. Can you tell us about Dwight and the role that he played in the show?
Yeah, sure. It's a very different kind of character because so many of the characters, they feel grounded in reality. They feel like people that you might know. Dwight, he's sort of this quasi-Amish beet farmer who's into heavy metal and Star Wars and Lord of the Rings. He's just this wild mass of contradictions that make no sense if you think about them. And he's a nerd, but he's a ladies' man. I mean, there's all these weird things that they threw in there, but Rainn is so clever and so funny that he made it seem real. And it's just this brilliant character.
Mm-hmm. What was it about the way Rainn Wilson portrayed Dwight that made the character so funny?
He made him just sort of person who craves authority, who's almost a fascist, who just looks to Michael as a god. He has this blind obedience to this buffoon.
Okay, first, let's go over some parameters. How many people can I fire?
None. You're picking a healthcare plan.
Okay, we'll table that for the time being. Two, I'm gonna need an office. I think the conference room should be fine.
You can use the conference room as a temporary workspace. You can use it.
Thank you.
So it created an amazing dynamic of this idiot boss who's actually a good salesman, which is a weird thing, but who's a terrible boss, and his underling is this just really bizarre nerd who worships him and his power. And it was this amazing dynamic that worked for seven seasons.
Larry Wilmore was a staff writer for a couple of seasons, and he says that although The Office looks like a workplace show, it's really a romantic comedy. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think the hook of so many people was the Jim and Pam romance. It's the through line of the key second season and the third season. And it was it's why people kept tuning in just to see what would happen. And John Krasinski and Jenna Fischer were so talented at conveying a sort of yearning for each other that they couldn't act on because she was engaged to a warehouse worker.
Solitaire?
Yeah, free sale.
6 on 7.
I know, I saw that.
So then why didn't you do it?
I'm saving that because I like it when the cards go.
Who doesn't like that?
It was just this incredible romance that was very compelling.
Steve Carell left The Office after the seventh season. The show continued for two more seasons. How well do you think the show held up after Steve left?
It was a complete disaster. I mean, I was told by a writer in that era that they realized later that he was a load-bearing character. And if you take out that supporting wall, the entire thing, it just fell down. But I would argue that even before he left, the show was showing some rust. That by the seventh season, they've lost a bunch of the best writers, and Greg Daniels left to go run Parks and Rec. So if you watch season seven, it's full of duds. The tone changed. It was more sitcom-y. It was not as funny. It was showing its age. And by this point, Pam and Jim are married to each other, and they have a child, and that tension is gone. And then Steve Carell leaves, and it was just an absolute disaster. It did not work.
The Office is the number one most watched acquired show on Netflix. Why do you think it's still so popular 15 years after it debuted?
I think partially it's just very, very funny. And Peak TV, it's produced so many great shows and so many great dramas and mysteries and documentaries and thrillers, but very few great sitcoms and very few shows that are just that funny. So the ability to just go on Netflix and binge on 9 seasons of a show that's that clever and that's relatable is just such a gift now to so many people.
The subtitle of your book is The Untold Story of the Greatest Sitcom of the 2000s. But let's open it up even more. Where do you think The Office ranks among the greatest sitcoms of all time?
I think top 5. I think it's up there with I Love Lucy, Cheers, and Seinfeld. Is sort of a timeless show that'll be funny now in even 50 years.
Yeah. Andy Green, thank you very much.
Sure, of course. It was very nice being here.
Andy Green is a senior writer for Rolling Stone and the author of The Office, the untold story of the greatest sitcom of the 2000s. Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Barry Sonnenfeld, Karen Tongson, and Andy Green. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Special thanks to producer Brad Kohlberg.
He has his Netflix sent here to the office and he watches them in pieces when things are slow.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Is there no limit to what he won't notice?
Our executive producer, nay, showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
I always appreciate constructive criticism about my job performance. I thrive on it.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Take care and stay safe out there. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
Don't think of it as a demotion, just think of it as a promotion to a lower level.